Good morning. Happy belated Father's Day. For all older fathers, for fathers who are in need of care, for fathers who have died, let us remember and uphold. For active fathers who are in the thick of parenting, let us honor your important work and say thank you. Whatever kind of fathering we have received in our lives, let us all acknowledge the unique power of fatherly influence. In his famous sermon on Unitarian Christianity, William Ellery Channing had this to say about fatherly power. To give our views of God in one word, we believe in his parental character. We ascribe to him not only the name, but the dispositions and principles of a father. We believe that he has a father's concern for his creatures, a father's desire for their improvement, a father's equity in proportioning his commands to their powers, a father's joy in their progress, a father's readiness to receive the penitent, and a father's justice for the incorrigible. We look upon this world as a place of education in which he is training men by prosperity and adversity, by aids and obstructions, by conflicts of reason and passion, by motives to duty and temptations to sin, by a various discipline suited to free and moral beings, for union with himself, and for a sublime and ever-growing virtue in heaven. Concern, desire, joy, these go along with serious and intentional fathering. We may or may not agree with Channing's Christian views, the God who disciplines humans for union with himself, but let us all agree to look upon this world as a place of education and appreciate the teachings of the fathers of our lives. That was a long few words before an invocation. May we be reminded here of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. With me now in the spirit of prayer. A prayer for the end of things. May we find peace at the end. At the end of a conversation with a friend or a stranger, may we find peace. At the end of a period of hard work, when we have struggled to complete a task or tried hard to find an approach to work together with others, may we find peace beyond our fatigue. At the end of an outing or an event we've looked forward to or a vacation we've planned endlessly for and lived through and enjoyed in the seeming blink of an eye, when it is time to return again to the regular rhythms and routines of our lives, may we find peace in the ordinary. At the end of the day when we retire to our beds, let us reflect on the fullness of our being, recounting our moments of strength and failure, and may we seek peace beyond our own stories, peace for ourselves and peace for our world. And at the end of our lives, whenever our time comes to the still, breathless place where we must let go, may we find peace beyond this life. so be it.
I offer you some farewell musings. But first, I wanted to share a few impressions from GA, the General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association that is taking place right now in Fort Worth. I attended for 3 days this week, 3 days of the multi-day extravaganza, which is GA. It is a lot like a film festival. There is so much going on, so many lectures, workshops, exhibitions, annual meetings, and worship events, that you must decide what you want to do most, because you cannot do it all. It is a real experiencing, it is a real exercise in expressing your priorities as a UU, and it completely overwhelmed me at first. But then I decided I wanted and needed to hear different UU theologies, and I did. They were there. I wanted to participate in mega church high-tech worship, to get with the trend, with thousands of others. I wanted to hear some award-winning sermons being preached. I wanted to learn more about the credentialing of ministers in our tradition. I wanted to get information about international liberal religious networks of ministry. And all of these things I did. They're all there. The offerings and possibilities of GA are many. I want now to encourage you to make the pilgrimage for yourselves 1 year, or maybe many. One of the best experiences for me was to see old friends greeting one another. Possibly these friendships were built and sustained by the annual reunion. But to see people's eyes light up, to see them wave enthusiastically to one another and embrace, it was a real upper. It was fun to meet up with folks from here among the crowds. There were 40 people from this congregation attending GA this year. And I met up with Hannah Wells, and I also met Kathy Harrington, your two former interns, before me. It's exciting to think that I'll be one of the lucky ones running to greet old friends in the years to come. I treasure such a vision of belonging to the wider community of our faith, especially at such a time as this, as I prepare to take my leave from you all. This will be the last time I speak from your pulpit as your intern, and I would like to take the time this morning to address a couple of questions which have been asked of me in response to my sermons from the last few months. These questions came from two longtime members, both former board presidents. One asked, "What is so great about serenity?" This came from a man who introduced me the first time I met him to the qualities of character he considered most definitive of Texan culture: resourcefulness and independence. He clearly valued these traits, but he wasn't so sure about serenity. Serenity is like tranquility and describes a calm and peaceful state. It is associated with serene weather, clear, fair, like a cloudless sky or a calm sea. In a person, serenity means to be free from disturbing emotions. I guess I see serenity as a sign of inner resourcefulness, which makes some space in a person between their inner emotions and their outward demeanor. It makes the difference between being reactive and responsive. A serene person is aware of her emotions, but not controlled by them. A serene person values her emotions, learns from them,
but is not defined or determined by them. Then the emotions become a resource for such a person, not the source of their well-being or lack of it. So, what is so great about serenity? Well, maybe as someone trying to develop pastoral skills, I have been giving a subtextual message that serenity is great. Great for a minister or a chaplain or someone whose job it is to reflect others' state of being back to them as a mirror. But then again, we come from a tradition of the priesthood of all believers, which means we all can and we are all called to show God's love or life's benevolence or life's possibility to each other. And I think we are all better able to do that from an inner landscape that is calm and undisturbed by stormy emotions. So serenity, then, is good for connecting our own truth beyond, for connecting to our own truth beyond our emotions, and for connecting with others. And I'll own up to my own bias that in life, it is connecting with others which seems great to me. A calling into significant, meaning-filled relationship with people. That's what ministry means to me. So that's what is so great about serenity. It facilitates or can facilitate deep and real connections. And that's my answer to the first question. The other question I wanted to deal with was a direct response to a particular remark I had made in a sermon, wherein I wondered about the experience of being hit by a car and lying badly injured by the side of the road. I had said that I would be able to rest my cheek on the ground under me, whether it was dusty or greasy or bloody, knowing the earth as an inalienable mother upon whom I may safely rest, trusting death as much as I have trusted life. It was this last idea about trusting death that sparked the question, how? How do we learn to trust death? Trusting death, that is perhaps a novel way to view death. We might intellectually accept the inevitability of death, but chances are we'd rather not think about it if given the choice. No, we deal with it when we have to, when we are confronted by it or stopped in our tracks by it. And then our mix of emotions is heavy, isn't it? Shock, disbelief, anger, sadness, confusion, uncertainty, regret, anxiety, an overwhelming complex of feelings envelops us as we move along the series of events unfolding in bedrooms, hospital rooms, and funeral homes. Indeed, is there any trust there in that picture? Death is the unwanted visitor separating us from our loved ones and sometimes from our hopes and dreams. How can we, why would we, trust it? People of conventional faiths may well trust that death is the beginning of eternal life, death in Jesus, alive forever with God, or that death is the transition point from one life into another, as within Hinduism or Buddhism and the ideas they have of reincarnation. Atheists may also share a kind of faith in death as a merciful nothingness, where there can be no pain because there is no thing at all. Other, even less conventional views wonder about the after-death experiences they've heard reported by people who have actually been clinically dead but returned to life. The whole white light at the end of the tunnel scenario, your life flashes before your eyes, the overwhelming, encompassing feeling of love there. Such compelling stories can enchant susceptible religious liberals, encouraging an understanding of death as some kind of passage between worlds or realms of being. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, no less, became such a believer, who, at the end of her career, 12 books after her famous 1969 book on death and dying, asserted that death did not exist, but was merely a portal to another stage. She said, quote, "Death is only a transformation from a physical field of energy into a psychic field of energy," end quote. And so, there are many ways to trust death, and our worldviews or religious views matter to our understandings, and they always have. We can look to whole heritages surrounding the care of souls at the end of life. I refer to the ancient traditions as revealed in various books of the dead. The ancient Egyptians were entombed with such books. Theirs were like instructions to help navigate the journey from life to death for the deceased. In the Celtic tradition of death midwifery, which influenced later monastic infirmary practices around Europe at the turn of the first millennium, there was a basic set of practices for giving active care to the dying based on the understanding that, like as in birth midwifery, people needed coaching at the end of life in much the same way. In the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which has become quite popular recently in the West, there are detailed instructions for the dying and for their caregivers at the end of life, including many prayers to be read to the dying person during the different stages of their transition from life to death to life, to help confront especially fear and fearful emotions and facilitate a calm and clear state of consciousness throughout the process. There is collective wisdom on the universal experience of dying to be found in these traditions. Their varied cultural and religious roots do not point to different, but to recurring approaches to death. And we can learn from the repeated patterns in the teachings that they have helped, that have helped past generations to trust death. So let's review the principles which emerge. First, there is the basic idea of a good death. This is a peaceful death, and it is achieved through close attention to the actual process of death through its many stages. Kubler-Ross identified the stages of grief in the dying process, and you probably all know them, the denial and anger, bargaining depression and acceptance. In hospices today, caregivers recognize the final active dying stage. In the Tibetan tradition, there were over 40 different stages identified in the dying process, and each stage was met with particular sets of practices, prayers, and rituals, all designed to support the dying person as well as their attendants. A good death included constant caretakers, so that the one at the end of life would not be alone to face approaching death. Another consistent teaching in these traditions was that it was necessary to prepare for death throughout the course of a lifetime, that the art of dying was not radically different from the art of living, but brought some powerfully transforming opportunities to review our lives with new perspectives and to heal our souls. Quote, "Dying is nothing to fear," said Kubler-Ross. "It can be the most wonderful experience of your life." The earliest hospices in Europe around the first millennium, they were scattered monastic infirmaries, and they were places where people from all walks of life and all faith traditions in the West went to die. They were treated with a variety of physical and what we might call psycho-spiritual techniques. Music was extensively used. In fact, there is some evidence that the West's musical scale emerged out of these institutions. Medicines were used to control pain and maintain lucidity. Psalms and chants were used to regulate the breath through pain and discomfort and give expression to the full range of the dying person's emotions, including anger at God. Death was consistently viewed as a sacred end-of-life transition, and it presented a unique opportunity for significant spiritual healing. The vision of a good death was in play then, and it is in play still. A recent poll has said that 82% of Americans would, upon being told they had very little time to live, prefer simply to go home. They want to die in their own beds, surrounded by family, in a setting that feels natural. But because we don't dwell on it, and because we haven't thought about it, the system that has sprung up to care for the elderly and the terminally ill is neither medically nor ethically consistent. In different regions of the country, even among the best hospitals, there are huge variations in the kind of treatment given to dying people. It seems, from a study done in 5 different regions, that the most important factor in determining whether a particular region has a high rate of medical intervention at the end of life, including risky operations, respirators, and artificial feeding, is not local religious practices, it's not personal wishes, but the local availability of hospital beds and the number of local doctors. So, how then can we learn to trust death? Well, we can be proactive about all the practical concerns, make our wills, make sure we give legal rights to folks who understand our wishes for the care at the ends of our lives. This church is particularly rich in resources with AMBIS, a great library on death and dying here in our library. We can join with the new movements towards at-home funerals and after-death care in the home. We can begin, and this is kind of radical, to attend to each other, our families and friends, at the end of our lives, to sit with one another at death vigils, and to attend to the profound experiences of caring for the dying and learning the lessons they can teach us about living. We can take seriously, and this is probably the most significant thing we can do, we can take seriously our own spiritual pain before death's shadow falls, asking ourselves, is this my life filled with meaning and purpose? Do I have a sense of reconciliation within myself and with others? Do I have a deep sense of connection with the people and things that matter most to me? The answers to such questions are in us, and they can guide us, seeking out the spiritual healing that will build lives worth living and set us up for a good death, a peaceful, conscious letting go, surrounded by a circle of friends, or lying by the side of the road. We can then take courage that we've cultivated in living fully, into the end-of-life experience, whatever we conceive it to be, claiming for ourselves a good death that we can trust. Dying is nothing to fear, said Kubler-Ross. It can be the most wonderful experience of your life. It all depends on how you have lived. But let's face it, none of us know when we will die. It could be tomorrow, it could be tonight. So we need to make an effort to trust life and death, and to live in the only moment we can, in the now. In the now, and with each other's blessings, let us endeavor to trust. As people of faith, we are called to do no less.